A climb up Mount Monadnock, a visit to Robert Smithson's Earthworks Spiral Jetty, and a porn festival in New York are some of the subjects covered in David Rakoff's third and latest book called Half Empty. No matter what the topic is, Mr. Rakoff comes across as a gentle curmudgeon. He says he's a relentless pessimist, but as his readers and listeners of This American Life already know, he's actually fun to be with. His new book is published by Doubleday, and I'm very pleased that it brings journalist, essayist, and actor David Rakoff back to our show. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Not to judge your book by this, but the cover depicts a cute Disney-esque bunny with a shotgun aimed at its forehead, a happy canoeist paddling toward a sheer drop, and a volcano exploding. And then there's a warning label that reads, "Warning. No inspirational life lessons will be found in these pages." Do you have something against inspirational life lessons?
I have something against something that labels itself as an inspirational life lesson. I think that the nature of an epiphany is that it's a short circuiting of logic, so it's something that you don't expect. If you give it the that kind of buildup, you're bound to fail. So there was that. That as a philosophy actually gets me through a lot of things. And the cover itself, the overwhelming sense you get, though, surely when you looked at the cover, is of a kind of a cheerful bucolic idyll, no?
Until you look at it in more detail.
Exactly, until you see, which is, I think, the nature of the world, don't you think?
Well, as I understand it, studies show that pessimists have a more realistic view of things.
I certainly think so.
But they're not as happy as optimists.
I don't think that that's actually true. This is the thing. The book began as a – the reason the book began was about 9 years ago I was sent by the New York Times Magazine to interview a woman named Julie Norum, who had written – she's a psychologist up at Wellesley. And she had written a book called The Positive Power of Negative Thinking, and it was about pessimism. And I couldn't really write the piece. It was very difficult for me. But one of the main things that I couldn't do is I couldn't tease apart the twin strands of – pessimism and its attendant anxiety, and happiness and sadness, which are indexed on completely different tables. So you can be very anxious and very pessimistic and completely happy. I couldn't understand that, and I certainly couldn't articulate that in writing for a long time. And so the first chapter of this book was an absolute bear. It took me almost 9 years to write. But it turns out, and I speak from personal experience right now, you can be completely anxious and neurotic and completely happy.
Well, you've written an awful lot, and yet you mentioned that that first chapter took you 9 years. You have a long and funny description of spending a day writing or trying to write and actually wasting the day and snacking, looking out the window, checking your email every 40 seconds and so forth. So when do you get the writing done?
It remains a mystery to me. It does remain a mystery to me, and I'm not being glib or reductive about that. I just don't have a physical memory of really sitting down and parking myself, you know, on my butt and doing my writing. Clearly it gets done. Although at the same time, I would point out, this is only my third book and I'm 46 years old. So it's not like I'm blazingly prolific.
Yeah, but you're doing other stuff. You're acting. You're
sure, I'm getting it done.
Life.
I'm earning a living and, you know, as a writer. So I'm clearly doing the writing somehow. But my emotional memory is of this catch-as-catch-can thing.
Now, you recently faced a second bout of cancer, the first one being in your 20s. Does that add to a sense of a glass half empty?
Not necessarily as the glass half empty as the world being a darker place than it really is.
More threatening or scary?
Yes, absolutely. And you know, I'm currently in chemotherapy, and I, you know, those fine gentlemen offered me some raw oysters in the green room. And, you know, Malpec oysters, I grew up on them. I'm Canadian, after all. Would it be a dream come true, but I can't eat raw seafood right now. But that's about as bad as it gets for me, I'm happy to say. It was very instructive, and it is very instructive to be sick right now. If you're writing a book that advocates that the world's darkness and the world's reality, and to truly assess them in all their, you know, pessimistic, real, dark glory, is something that you should do, and that it's not unbeautiful and it's not unhappy, and it's a proper way to be. It was a very put your money where your mouth is moment for me to then have to confront that. And so the final chapter of the book is actually about having gotten sick again.
Well, I was wondering about climbing Mount Monadnock. if I were concerned about my health, I might not do something. And you don't sound like the kind of guy who would go mountain climbing anyway.
It's true. That was a counterphobic experiment. That's actually from my first book. And it's one of the first things that I got to do as a reporter. And then it was one of the first things that I properly got to do for This American Life. And that was certainly marked the earlier part of my writing career. Was everything was a counterphobic experiment. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, everything is a counterphobic experiment right now anyway, because...
But it makes for more interesting writing when you're writing about something where you,
of your
you
comfort
have to overcome
zone. Exactly. And basically everything is out of my comfort zone. I don't hate the world, but I am scared of the world. So everything is essentially, if it's unfamiliar, my a priori feeling about it is that it's terrifying.
You seem to regard yourself as lucky despite all of this, and seem to have an active feeling of luck that you don't live in the third world or in Europe during the Middle Ages. Well, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, but I feel...
During the bubonic plague.
Well, exactly.
Every day I wake up and say, thank God I wasn't born during the bubonic plague.
Look, during the 50s, here's the thing. Three times a day, and I'm not joking about this, three times a day I am overwhelmed with two things. One is a nostalgia and a wish that I could have seen New York in the 1950s. And the other is just a feeling of immense gratitude that I get to live in New York at all. But when you deconstruct nostalgia... You know, there were quotas against Jews. There were quotas against, they were raiding gay bars. You know, it wouldn't, I don't feel terribly nostalgic, but I do feel immensely fortunate for the things in my life.
Well, I did live in New York during the 50s,
yes.
But I was totally oblivious to just how great it was. I only realize it after the
fact. In retrospect. I guess that retrospect is also my problem too. Although, no, I feel immensely grateful lately. And that might be a certain Pollyanna effect of the illness and undergoing treatment and stuff.
Our public radio listeners probably know you best for your contributions to This American Life. How did you get that gig?
That happened because I was doing theater with David Sedaris, and we were friends, and we were doing downtown off-Broadway theater. And Ira, who had produced him for Morning Edition by that point, was still a cub reporter, you know, for NPR on, I think, the education beat. And then Ira put together this show, which was initially called Your Radio Playhouse. And it truly was that. It was just all the folks he knew, you know, making contributions. And then it became This American Life. And then that happened. So it really was a right place at the right time kind of thing for me. But I owe them everything. I owe them my career.
Well, I'm assuming you reached, to some degree, the same audience with your writing and with the performances. But there's also separate audiences, aren't there? When you go to readings, does everybody know that you're on This American Life?
No. Very often I have the experience where people have never heard of me and they've come to me through. I'm not really sure why they've come there. But yeah, book readers. It really is a range of ages. You know, the hipster radio people whom I adore. And then there's also my other constituency, which is older, you know, bookish folks, you know, 92nd Street Y sort of cranky Hebrews like myself. So that's also nice.
I do a lot of things at the 92nd Street Y, so I know what you're talking about. You adapted the screenplay and starred in the live action short film, The New Tenants, which won an Academy Award this year.
It did.
For Best Live Action Short Film.
Yeah, that was crazy.
So that's another thing. Do you want to start making more films?
No. You know, The New Tenants was so wonderful because it was done with friends of mine and, you know, the stakes were very low and we did it all together. But in terms of really going out and getting actual acting work, I'm not thin-skinned enough. I'm rather too thin-skinned for it at this point in my life. The rejection would be too much. And, you know, truthfully, in the world of actual Hollywood, I'm a nobody and a nothing from nowhere. And for me to be as well treated in that world as I am in the world of writing, I'd have to be Julianne Moore, and I'm not.
Well, you could write a successful screenplay, have a hit movie, and I'm curious about the essays again. The early work, you say, was counterintuitive topics.
Counterphobic, yeah.
Okay, what about now? What attracts you to a certain subject?
What attracts me to a certain subject are the things that have sort of always attracted me, which is, would I learn something? You know, I love those ones, reportorial stories where I go out and I actually get to learn something. But you go into everything with a hypothesis of how it's going to be. And I guess the thing that I always look for is, is this not reductive? You know, is its point essentially sort of a nuanced experience of something? I don't want to do something just for easy laughs. And I certainly turn down a lot of stuff or don't even embark on a lot of stuff for just those reasons. Stories invariably surprise me. And the fact that I can even finish a story is always surprising.
But you also grew up the child of a psychiatrist and a psychotherapist. So stories were part of your childhood, weren't they? Or didn't your parents talk about that?
Oh, we certainly never talked about. I mean,
really? They didn't tell the stories of their patients?
Are you kidding? No.
Oh, to each other?
Well, possibly to each other, but certainly not with us. I mean, they might have because they were, you know, both physicians, but oh my goodness, no. I mean, discretion and confidentiality were truly paramount in my home growing up.
Was it possible to make a comment without having them say that you were projecting or that you were having a reaction formation?
Oh, very, very much so, because, you know, remember, I'm Canadian, so, and I was Canadian in the 1960s. It was a much more British kind of thing. So it was not that kind of American stereotype of, you know, you have penis envy and all that stuff. It just didn't, it didn't come up in that way. That was very much an American phenomenon. We were much more buttoned up and discreet in Canada when I was growing up.
You still, I don't know whether they were Freudians or not. A Freudian is a Freudian.
No, they were not Freudians. They were, you know, general. Well, my father's a psychiatrist. My mother's just a GP, you know, a real doctor, as we liked to joke. But
both from South Africa originally.
Yes, originally South African Jews.
So this is even more complicated. And you have dual citizenship, U.S. and Canadian.
Yes. So it's all that mongrelhood, all that errant, wandering Jew sort of stuff. So it's, but no, we were terribly British and we didn't really talk about anything. But I guess it imbues the fabric of one's, you know, growing up.
Well, it also it influences the way you see the world. If you grew up in a psychologically oriented environment, you tend to see things in psychological terms.
Yes, undoubtedly. And it's also turned me very discreet. I hold a lot of secrets.
David Rakoff will be reading and signing books, although not revealing any secrets, on Wednesday night at 7 at Three Lives Bookstore. He'll be reading and signing books on Thursday night at 7:30. At Greenlight Bookstore, and he will be in conversation with Sloane Crosley on Wednesday, October 20th at 7:30 at Symphony Space. They will be introduced by Ira Glass. For more information about all of these events, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. His latest book is called Half Empty, and it is published by Doubleday. And I want to thank you for being with us again
today. Thanks for having me again.